All right. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. As we said earlier, we'll talk to Amanda Signorelli. She's the CEO of Tech Week. Tech Week Chicago is fully underway, and their big full day of events, I think, comes up tomorrow. So we'll talk to Amanda about that. Frank Sennett will come by from Crain's Chicago Business to talk about, well, a number of stories in Crain's, but one of them is a burger chain that is no longer accepting cash. They're not going to take cash from people anymore, only credit cards or debit cards. And Terry Savage is here. She talks about personal finance on most Wednesdays. And so we were talking about that, and I told you that I use now a credit card for everything. I never use cash. I said I use a credit card at a soda machine. And you,
there are no soda machines. A pop machine? You can put a credit card in to get a Coke or a Pepsi?
Yeah, they're right here in the Tribune Tower in the lobby. Absolutely.
Well, they're getting a cut of that.
Well, maybe, but I don't ever use, I never use cash. And you kind of scoffed at me like,
well,
that was
terrible. For little things, I think, you know, I used to say, oh, write down every little bit of cash so you can make a budget and know where it all went. But I mean, the convenience of cash for small things makes a lot of sense. You know, it's been a long time, but in Europe, you can't get cash. Nobody wants to take cash.
Right.
For, this is for decades now. And there's a discount for using cash because the very act of bundling it up and carting coins around
costs money. Is
very costly. Those guys that come around in the armored trucks picking up the cash from the pop machine. So, I understand why it's more efficient. It just seems sort of silly to put your credit card in for a dollar for a pop.
Well, no, it's $1.75.
Well, don't drink that. There's water in the hallway.
All right. Well, I think it was at Sweden or somewhere. They were talking about going completely cashless a few years ago.
We've always heard about the cashless society.
Right.
It may very well be, except for the underground economy, which, of course, will either be cash or gold coins. Or maybe Bitcoin.
After the show, I'll go buy you a $1.75 soda in the.
I would not want to drink it, and that's without the city's new tax and the whatever.
Yeah, I think it's actually over $2 now.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so there's that. All right, bigger news: the King of Saudi Arabia has named a new crown prince.
And why do we care? Fascinating. A fascinating
31-year-old guy, right?
Yep. And a very cool guy, Prince Salman, we are told, and there's been lots written about him. And he is very modern compared to the ancient monarchy that's ruled Saudi Arabia. And he is a young guy, and he has been known to state publicly that Saudi's future is in diversifying away from oil revenues. He considers oil in the ground a wasting asset because technology will develop solar or nuclear or fission or fusion or something like that. So you get the sense that he's going to sell a lot more oil. That's very bearish on oil prices.
So
good for you as
cash,
a driver.
Get the cash while he can.
That's exactly what he wants to do because he thinks there'll be other alternative sources of energy. And he wants to diversify the Saudi economy. So that's a really, really big change, and it puts downward pressure on oil. And oil, as you know, the Wall Street Journal, I was shocked to read the headline, oil's officially in a bear market. It's a little above 43 now. If it goes under $40 a barrel, it changes a lot of things, including the Fed's plan to raise interest rates because inflation is out there. But inflation is not out there, and oil energy prices are a big component.
Chicago Fed President Charles Evans talked today, right? He talked about
he was on Squawk Box on CNBC, and Charles Evans, a great guy, is known as to be pretty dovish, and he hasn't been one of those who wanted to raise prices. And he said, in addition to this energy thing, he made a really interesting point without naming names, that there's some big mega deals, mega mergers. So let's try Whole Foods and Amazon, although he didn't say that. That will so create efficiency in some of the basic core economic inflation statistics. There'll be so much efficiency that prices can come down because of these mega mergers. And therefore, the Fed may not, he hinted, be able to follow through with its planned third increase later in the year.
Which is coming when? September?
That's $64 trillion
question.
I know.
But they're thinking in the September
October, maybe December. But the point is, A, we don't see inflation because energy prices are coming down and this move in Saudi Arabia would tend to bring oil prices down. B, we're having mega mergers that bring maybe food prices down. So
why would the Fed want to increase rates? Just to get it back to
a little
more normal?
The Fed wants to get back to normal so that they have ammunition to cut rates again if there's ever a real problem. But it's just hard to push on a string like that.
Hey, if I were to ask you the two biggest movers this year on the Dow, Could you tell me off the top of your head?
I think McDonald's would be one of them.
Yeah, they're both in Chicago. McDonald's is number two and Boeing number one.
I'm a longtime shareholder of McDonald's. Well, I served on their board for 12 years.
And happy to see it. I mean, I spent some time at their corporate headquarters a few years ago. And,
well, good, because it's not going to be there anymore.
Exactly. But, you know, they've been so maligned and beleaguered that it's nice to see that there's a little
always
reward.
A reminder that what you think and feel, whether it's about a politician or a stock or its product, you know, Peter Lynch of Magellan Fund Fidelity years ago famously said, buy what you know, buy what you see, buy what you like. I remember buying Amazon stock, which I still have. I can't tell you how many years ago when I realized it was more than just books. But I must be addicted to Amazon because I don't go in stores anymore. So there's one article of faith that says invest in what you know and love and use. And another is, you know, companies can become more profitable even though you may or may not use them or like their product. And so you shouldn't be blinded only to stocks that you love.
All right. So we've killed almost all the time.
Darn.
I don't know if we have time to talk about deodorant.
What did you say? This is the curveball you said you had?
No, I just said, so.
Am I taking this personally?
It has nothing to do with you. No, it has
we sit
to do.
Across the
so
desk.
So I left you. I came and sat in the studio, and there was an ad on our air for Dove Men's Antiperspirant.
I've been hearing it.
Right, and so that's kind of it.
The guy says, is it sweat that you're supposed to call it? It smells good.
The deodorant market is up 23% in the past 5 years, and they say it's going to go up another 16% in the next three or four by 2021.
So much for that don't sweat it commercial.
Well, it's the same machine, right? We're sweating probably the same.
Maybe because it's the financial markets and the economy, and everybody's worried they're suddenly noticing a need for deodorant.
I think people have more cash, and people are going more toward natural stuff.
The natural stuff costs more. I am not qualified to debate this with you.
All right, so take a couple minutes and give me all your thoughts on the increasing market share for deodorant. Okay, we're out of time. Well, we'll come back.
My jaw dropped, everybody. I wish you could have seen me. My jaw. I just sat there looking, and I'm like, are you serious?
Are you in a column about what records you save, what records you don't, and all
financial
that?
Financial papers, yes.
So let's kick that around after we take a break. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG, and it's 1223 on this Wednesday afternoon, a beautiful Wednesday afternoon. Really, Terry Savage is in the studio. She writes about personal finance for Tribune Publishing, for Huffington Post.
Yeah, the Tribune syndicates my column all around the country now. I love it, getting messages from readers from all over.
So you can see the columns there, or you can go to terrysavage.com. And your latest is about, and this is one, how many times have you written this column?
I've written this column probably 14 times over the last 35 years I've been writing a column.
The question is, how long do you save financial documents?
One of our listeners, or maybe with someone from WGN-TV on Wednesday mornings, sent me a note on my blog. They asked Terry and said, look, I think it was a mortgage that was over and done with and paid off. Can I throw it away? And I need to do some full disclosure. You're a hoarder, aren't you? But an organized hoarder. There's a little box for every single year that I have worked with this a lot. Okay, so now I have shelves in my basement, and there are these file boxes, banker boxes.
Does it make it less of a hoarder if you keep it neat?
Oh, absolutely. But you know those people that collect things like frogs, China frogs?
Right.
You know, five of them are cute.
Right.
Seven is a little bit of an overkill, but now they've got them on every surface in their house. I'm probably the equivalent of that.
Okay, so we have a little bit in common here because when I was single, living in my condo, I would, at the end of each year, get a little cardboard box, and I would put all my papers in it from the year. And I'm talking about all my credit card statements, my banking.
Yeah.
From 85, 6, 7. I obviously don't need any of that now.
If you asked me for my Saks Fifth Avenue bill from February 1985, I could go to the basement and find it for you in a minute.
It's kind of fun, you know, especially maybe you do this more than me, but I want to one day be able to go back and look at those. Like, this is what I was spending a month.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Don't say it out loud because it really makes it sound kind of bad because most people don't think of that as fun. They think
it's very weird. I avoid the dentist like the plague, but I organize stuff. But what's happened now is we're a generation that is baby boomers are moving out and they want to get rid of stuff. And millennials are, you know, they're digital. And so I thought it was important to write about
what you
need to keep either digitally or what you need originals for.
Why do I need to save any statements if I'm getting it from a brokerage firm or investment firm? Because they've all got a digital record.
You should save your year-end statement. Well, first of all right, let me go down the list. First of all, you have your tax records. I personally think you should keep them forever, even though 3 years is a traditional IRS look back for an audit, 6 years if they suspect material underreporting. But, you know, there is no time limit on an investigation for fraud. So you may have been involved with someone inadvertently who they've targeted for fraud, and they want to look back. Anyway, keep your tax records as long as you have space and make space. If you own stocks outside of a retirement plan, well, of course, you have to document your cost basis. Unless you die with them, and then that becomes your heir's cost basis, the value on the date of death. But if you sell them, you want to document that. Of course, in a retirement plan, keep your year-end statements. Don't forget, you're going to at some point have required minimum distributions.
But that stuff's online too, right?
It is online. And I just suggest that you keep it in some format. That's not stuff you have to have in paper, but real estate records. You know, over the years, you live in a house for 22 years, you put on a new roof, you put in a new furnace. So even if you had a very low cost way back then,
right,
you can raise your cost basis by keeping good records of improvements.
Interesting. So I think also, too, because the generation after me or two, you know, they're so used to not keeping anything on paper.
Anything. That's the whole point.
That they won't keep it. And even when it comes to like birth certificates or things like that.
Well, now, there's a separate category. That's the keep forever and keep it in its original form. Go get a file box. I used to say metal, but a plastic file box. Now you can get anywhere. And put things that you really will need someday and you'll don't want to scramble to find. A real birth certificate, a certified copy, not just a Xerox copy of it. Death certificates for a spouse, military separation records. They provide a headstone if you've served in the military, divorce decrees, your estate plan, the real insurance policy that you have, the actual policy
The
paper policy, the ones that are current. And you may have deeds or titles to real estate or real property, your boat, maybe your car, stuff like that. And you know, some people still have, and I have a few, stock certificates from the days of when everything was non-electronic.
You can get the list at terrysavage.com, read the column. Your assignment this week is to go to the basement. I want you to go to 1988, let's say September.
I'll do this.
And I want to know what your Saks Fifth Avenue bill was for September.
I want to know.
Well,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to do that and bring it in here.
All right. We'll see it next week.
Okay.
Terry Savage, good to see you. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Frank Sennett is on the phone line from Crane Chicago Business to talk about some of the story. I'm glad, Frank, I'm glad you could squeeze us in today because I know you're trying to get back into hockey shape now that we heard about Marian Hossa. So thanks for taking the time.
I am ready to step in.
Are
yes. Sure. I got my skates all shined or all sharpened. So,
and you're short of 38, so you could step in there.
Sure.
So I want to start with the story about Epic Burger because it's interesting to me. I mean, I just think, you know, we were talking to the people from CMAP yesterday about the future of transportation and where we're going to be, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now. I think it's going to be much sooner than that to where we are a cashless society. More and more businesses are just not dealing with cash anymore, and Epic Burger is the latest.
Yeah, you know, if Wimpy comes in and says, "Oh, glad to see you Tuesday for a hamburger today," that's just not going to work out. Epic Burger at all of its 8 locations in Chicago is cashless as of June 12th. You have to have a credit card or, you know, a friend that's willing to spot you if you are going to buy a burger there. And they join Argo T, which has started taking some of its locations cashless as well. And there are others following suit. So it seems to be a real trend.
Kevin Richter, the producer for Bill and Wendy, we were talking about it between shows, and he said he goes to a lot of different restaurants where it might not be of Epic Burger or a chain or making news, but, you know, there are a lot of businesses in the city that just they don't bother with it anymore.
And it's funny, you do also have this kind of retro thing. There are some businesses that only accept cash that you can't do credit cards at, like Big Star.
Right.
On Milwaukee and a Heaven on 7, you know, everybody's friend Jimmy Vannis got to go to hit the ATM. But it does seem like we're moving in the other direction.
Okay, but so that makes – there's a little more – well, I guess there's logic on both sides. But the logic of only cash is it costs the business money to – every time there's a credit card transaction, right? Whereas cash, it wouldn't be that way.
Yeah, there's a transaction fee associated. And I guess what Epic Burger decided was that there's enough of a hassle in dealing with cash, though, that it's worth the extra cost of the transaction fees. And there are costs associated with taking that deposit down. And as the head of Epic Burger said, David Friedman, the founder, that takes a target off the back of their employees.
Yeah, they had a robbery, didn't they?
Robbed. Yeah, they had a robbery that really spurred them to move the pace up on this. They waited until their cash business was below 20% of transactions, and then they took the leap. They said there's been some walkaways, but overall, it hasn't hurt the business.
Yeah, so that's the key. Even before they did it, well, I mean, now I guess it's zero, but before they did it, the cash transaction percentage was less than 20%. So short of being forced to move away from cash, I think we're all doing it anyway. I mean, I will go to an ATM and I'll get $100 out and it will last me weeks and weeks and weeks. I spend way too much, but I just never use cash. I just, you know, I'm on the train this morning and I run out of my 10 ride. I renew it on my phone. I guess I buy coffee in the morning with cash, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same way. I laugh at the people at the toll booths anymore. You know, you got to have the little fob and, that's where we're moving with everything.
All right. So if you take all the houses in the Chicago area, add up the residential property, add up their market value, Dennis Rodkin and Crane says you would come to $528 billion. That's a lot of money. But the fact is that the Chicago market has lagged behind the country when it comes to recovery from the real estate crash of almost 10 years ago now. And he says that we are about $107 billion short of where we should be. Dennis is going to be on the show tomorrow, but before that, tell me, what's he talking about? Where does he get these numbers?
Yeah, so we're lagging about 20 percentage points behind what the national average is for the recovery after the housing crash. So he just did the math in the six-county area. That's Cook, DuPage, Kane, Lake, McHenry, and Will counties. And he said, okay, here's what the real estate valuation is for residential property is now. What would it be if we had that 20% boost that would get us to the national average? And it's kind of a shockingly large figure, $107 billion, as you say. And that's, you know, money that doesn't contribute to the tax base. Obviously, there'd be higher tax revenues, more money for schools, et cetera. But on the other side, it's more affordable housing here than in a lot of places, like San Francisco, for instance.
Or Portland. I know Portland's been hot.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's psychological, too, right? So it's hard to know, because if your house was worth $100,000 more than it is now, you might be willing to go to Target and spend more money. You might be feeling a little more flush than you are. So there probably are great indirect costs as well, or indirect effects, I guess I should say.
Yeah, and to your point, in addition to the psychological value, as you know, you can get a home equity loan to do improvements and pay off credit card bills, as they say in the ads or whatever. So there's a very direct effect, too, of not having that value, is there's less capital available, less equity available to generate some free cash.
You know, and Dennis and I have been talking about the Case-Shiller report comes out, and how, you know, I think only just recently was Chicago not at the bottom of that, of the top 20 cities, or the 20 cities they measure. And my approach always is like, I'm in my house. I'm not going to go anywhere for a long time. It doesn't have much of an impact. But the fact is, for a lot of middle class people, home equity is where their wealth is. Right.
That's your big transaction in life, for sure. Yeah.
And
especially senior citizens, when they're getting ready to sell, if they need to sell, they get to a more accessible place or a more affordable place. If the valuation isn't there, they do take a bite. Yeah.
You talked about the fact that things are a little more affordable. There's that. But the other thing in the story that I kind of like, I think maybe there's a downside, but he writes about the fact that, you know, a lot of these suburbs that would do things on their own, whether it's IT or I don't know, pick something else, they're now starting to share with other suburbs. So you might have three or four different communities sharing an IT guy, or I keep wanting to say mosquito abatement, but that's not the same thing. But, you know, they're combining, they're consolidating. So that probably would mean less government spending, and that's not all bad either.
Not at all. If you can find efficiencies, as Dennis notes, Illinois infamously has more units of local government than any other state.
Right.
And so anywhere we can trim the fat there and have people working together instead of in separate units, all for the good.
Yeah, you know, it used to be able, you could buy a star at Christmas time and name a star. You can buy a township supervisory post if you want in Illinois. I'm going to go for Rockville. I want to be the Rockville Township Supervisor.
Perfect.
Frank Sennett, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Orion was talking about maples. Forget the maple syrup. Let's talk about tequila. Who knew that George Clooney, first of all, had a tequila brand, and apparently he's cashing in big time. Right, Kim? That's the news today?
Yeah, he sold it for almost $1 billion. He's having a great week. Not only did he get, you know, two healthy twins, but now he's getting almost $1 billion for the sale of this tequila business.
It's, you know, it's almost a takeoff. There was the show Entourage, right? One of the members of Entourage started a
yes,
tequila
Turtle
business.
Had a tequila company.
Turtle. So I wonder if Turtle, if that sort of character move was inspired by George Clooney.
It very well could have. He's only had it for 4 years, but he's also, you know, he has to split that billion with Randy Gerber, who's Cindy Crawford's husband, and Michael Meldman. So they're partners in the deal.
Well, I would imagine Amanda
It'll
Cigarelli.
It'll be a little rough.
Yeah, Amanda maybe wants to talk to them, see what they can do for Tech Week. Amanda Cigarelli is on the phone line now, right? Could they help you out?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can. The CEO of Tech Week. All right, it's Tech Week in Chicago this week. And Amanda, I want you to give me a little bit of a primer, because it's one of those phrases we hear comes to town. I know you have it in other towns as well, or cities. And from what I read, it was this wild party until you took the reins. Is that the case?
We've definitely had quite a few changes, to say the least, and had an opportunity to learn from many years. It's been great to see it evolve for, this is our seventh year, which is great. And so this year, everything that we're doing is all about deep content and thinking through what can we do to really take insights from the best companies here in Chicago and turn them into an opportunity for other people in the ecosystem to learn.
All right, so to back up a little bit and tell me just exactly what Tech Week is, because I know you have it, you know, is it like the auto show that goes from one city to the next? Is there a cohesiveness from city to city, or what exactly is Tech Week?
Great question. So Tech Week is an international festival that brings together tech entrepreneurs, visionaries, and leaders. That's the headline. Now, the way that it comes to life in every single city is actually quite different. And a lot of that has to do with the nuances of every single market that we engage. So a couple really cool examples I like to think about. In Kansas City, we partner with the state of Missouri. There's a huge push around big data, IoT, Cisco Smart Cities is out there. And so a lot of the content you see is specifically around those themes, whereas in Detroit, what you see is all about automobility. And so the ways that we partner with every single market change. And in Chicago in particular, the hometown of B2B companies that are targeting specifically businesses to businesses, mostly on the software side. So these companies are the ones that really anchor everything, along with some cool hardware, which is where you get to have things like robots and HoloDogs, which is also part of the Tech Week experience.
So you kind of act as maybe a facilitator, but what you're facilitating varies from city to city.
You nailed it. We are very much a reflection of the city, and a big part of that is being able to engage the community and say, hey, what's the most important trends, companies, leaders in your particular city that we can bring to life with our platform?
What's important for you to get? Because it looks to me like the numbers of participants has been going down, but I don't know from what I read about Tech Week that that's necessarily a bad sign for you, is it?
That's a great question. It's not a bad sign. I think the biggest thing for us is, back in the day, to your earlier point, we used to have a lot of events that were much more of a giant concert. We would literally have concerts that were on the South Drive that would take over. We'd have thousands and thousands of people. This year, yes, you definitely don't have the 15,000 that you used to have, but instead you've still got 8,000 to 10,000 people that are coming in. And instead of saying, hey, I'm here for the concert, they're coming in and saying, I'm here to learn. I'm here to go to these specific panels. I'm here to go to these workshops. I'm here to go to these individual events. So it's not a bad thing at all. It's very much a piece of being more focused, more refined, and telling people, if you're going to come, we really are excited to have you, but we also want to make sure you get value out of the time you spend with us by getting a piece of knowledge or a great connection out of the experience.
All right, when I read about you and I read about Tech Week, I keep coming across this phrase, hero companies. Explain for me what hero companies are and why you're targeting them.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, Tech Week's mission is to exist to spread wealth creation across diverse places and people through supporting the emergence of hero companies. So to your question, what is a hero company? These are tech businesses that are both substantial and sustainable, have big business models, and are really growing and have hit their stride. The bigger piece here, and the way that we translate it into very tactical and tangible terms, is if you look at all the markets that we operate in, and we think, how do we continue to grow them? How do we spur economic growth in Chicago, in Dallas, in Kansas City, in New York, all of them? What we heard continuously throughout all of our different sessions last year in 2016 was that you need to have more success, backing more winners, and actually having those entrepreneurs go back out and start more companies. You look at the original origins of Silicon Valley, it started with the idea of this Fairchild Semiconductor, which then led to another company, which then led to another 20 companies, and they were all spinoffs. So the best example I can give you here in Chicago is we need more companies like Clever Safe. That was a phenomenal example of a company that, once it was sold to IBM, produced 80 individual millionaires, resulted in benefits to the actual economic programs through here at IIT, where they're able to build more tech engineering talent, and then three or four more companies that were spun out of that. We need more of those examples. So CleverSafe is a great example of a hero company today.
Amanda Signorelli, the CEO of TechWeek. I know you're very busy this week. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. And hope everyone can get a chance to attend and look at the schedule. It's at techweek.com/Chicago.